From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
5'8", and there were piles of bodies twice my height along the sides of the road leading, you know, for miles. And it was women holding their children in the final throes of death and old people struggling to breathe.
Janine Gigiovanni, one of the most experienced war correspondents in the world, bears witness from Chechnya to Sierra Leone, from Janine to Iraq. Then journalist and hip-hop historian Davey D on the Clear Channeling of America.
We're making these recordings and making it known that what is on these airwaves is bought and paid for by corporations.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, as many as 15,000 U.S. and Iraqi forces have launched a major new offensive in Baghdad, the largest joint offensive to date. Overnight, the military reported the arrest of 300 people as part of what's being called Operation Squeeze Play. Over the past month, some 550 people have been killed in a series of attacks, largely in Baghdad. Earlier this morning, the commander of Iraq's new counterinsurgency headquarters was assassinated. Major General Wael Rubai was a top aide to Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri. His main job was coordinating the fight against the Iraqi resistance. His driver was also shot dead. Meanwhile, more signs are emerging. The U.S. intends to stay in Iraq for years to come. The Washington Post is reporting the U.S. plans to build four new giant military bases inside Iraq. Under the plan, the U.S. would station most of its troops in these heavily fortified bases designed to withstand mortar fire. Currently, the U.S. is operating out of more than 100 bases throughout the country. A spokesperson for the Sunni Iraqi Islamic Party warned the U.S. about the plan. He said, quote, they appear to settling in for a long run, and that will only give fuel for the terrorists. And Sunni Iraqis are planning to temporarily shut down their mosques to protest recent raids led by the Shiite-led Iraqi government. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration wants to enlist the Postal Service in its fight in the so-called war on terror. The Senate Intelligence Committee is expected to consider giving the FBI greater power to track mail sent through the Postal Service. Under one proposal, postal officials would be required to hand over information on the outgoing and incoming mail of anyone connected to foreign intelligence investigations. The FBI would still need a search warrant to actually open the mail. In the Middle East, Israeli hecklers greeted First Lady Laura Bush during her visit Sunday to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. The protesters demanded the release of the Jewish-American spy Jonathan Pollard from U.S. jail. Armed Israeli security personnel were forced to lock arms and form a human blockade in order to keep the protesters away from the First Lady, who was surrounded by Secret Service. Later in the day, an Israeli SWAT team was called in to calm Palestinian protests while Laura Bush visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque. In Florida, an Army recruiter has been arrested for raping a potential recruit. According to police, the rape occurred after the recruiter invited the 20-year-old to his apartment to take a recruiting exam on his computer. Amnesty International has announced it'll support a U.S. war resistor who fled to Canada to avoid fighting in Iraq. The international human rights group said it would consider Jeremy Hinsman to be a prisoner of conscience if he is deported back to the United States and jailed. Hinsman has sought political asylum in Canada, but his refugee claim was rejected 2 months ago. He's now appealing that decision to the Canadian federal court. If Hinsman was forced to return to the United States, he would face up to 5 years in jail. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for our interview with Jeremy Hinsman. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is meeting with President Bush today in Washington. Karzai, as well as the United Nations, has called for an investigation into new reports of U.S. soldiers abusing detainees in Afghanistan. In one incident, 22-year-old taxi driver died after being hung from the roof of his cell by his wrists. During his trip to Washington, Karzai is expected to ask Bush to allow the Afghan government to be given more power from the U.S. military. The Observer of London has reported Karzai is facing bitter criticism in Afghanistan for heavy-handed U.S. military tactics. Meanwhile, the family of former professional football player Pat Tillman has lashed out at the Bush administration for lying about the circumstances of Tillman's death in Afghanistan. Tillman made headlines when he quit the NFL to fight after the September 11th attacks. He died last year. The military initially misled the family into believing he was killed in battle, when in fact he was killed by friendly fire. In an interview with the Washington Post, Tillman's mother, Mary, said, quote, "The military let him down. The administration let him down. It was a sign of disrespect. The fact that he was the ultimate team player and he watched his own men kill him is absolutely heartbreaking and tragic. The fact that they lied about it afterward is disgusting," she said. A new review of major U.S. newspapers and magazines has found the publications are running almost no photographs from Iraq showing U.S. troops killed in action. Los Angeles Times recently reviewed news reports from September 1st of last year to the end of February of this year. During that period, 559 Americans and Western allies died. But readers of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Los Angeles Times, New York Times, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Washington Post never saw a single picture of a dead serviceman in their morning papers. Neither did readers of Time or Newsweek. Steve Strau, deputy director of photography at the LA Times, said, quote, "I feel we still aren't seeing the kind of pictures we need to see to tell the American people about this war and the costs of war." Veteran war photographer Chris Hondros added, quote, "I think if we're going to start a war, we ought to be willing to show the consequences of that war." Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has threatened to cut off diplomatic ties to Washington if the Bush administration refuses to hand over Luis Posada Cariles. Posada is the Cuban-born militant tied to the 1976 bombing of a commercial airliner. Posada is still wanted in Venezuela on terrorism charges. Chavez says Washington would be guilty of protecting international terrorism if it refused to extradite Posada. The Independent of London is reporting a new scientific study carried out by Monsanto raises new fears over the safety of genetically modified corn. The study, which the company has tried to keep secret, found that rats fed genetically modified corn developed abnormalities to internal organs and changes to the composition of their blood. In labor news, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is focusing its organizing efforts on more fast food restaurants following its successful campaign against Taco Bell. The farm workers group led a 3-year campaign to force Taco Bell to help improve working conditions for tomato pickers. Now the group is calling on McDonald's, Subway, and Burger King to follow Taco Bell's lead. The former chair of the Black Panther Party, Elaine Brown, is seeking political office. She has announced her candidacy for the mayor of Brunswick, Georgia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. With an increasing number of controversies swirling around journalists' coverage of war and occupation, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned that, quote, "people need to be very careful about what they say, just as people need to be careful about what they do," he said. Today, we take a look at the dangers the media faces both at home and abroad. Later in the program, we'll hear an address by hip-hop historian and journalist Davy D about the clear channeling of America. But first, we go to an interview with Janine DiGiovanni, one of the most experienced war correspondents in the world. She's worked for scores of newspapers, TV stations, and magazines. She's senior foreign correspondent for the Times of London. She also reports for the BBC and Vanity Fair. She's written a number of books about her experiences in war zones. She's featured in a new film by Barbara Koppel called Bearing Witness, which follows 5 female war correspondents. Her latest book is called Madness Visible, a Memoir of War. I spoke to her just a few weeks ago in our studio and began by reading her own words. She wrote, "In the 1990s, a series of violent wars kept coming, like wave after brutal wave. I was part of an elite, tight band of international reporters, a tribe, really, who roamed the earth, working from front lines or cities under siege. In those days, we rarely wore flak jackets, but we believed in the stories we were reporting and the importance of bearing witness to evil regimes, to ethnic cleansing, to genocide and systematic rape. After Israel came Bosnia, after Bosnia, Rwanda, Liberia, Congo, Chechnya, Sierra Leone, East Timor, Ivory Coast, Zimbabwe, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq. I know I've mercifully forgotten some, she wrote. Janine DiGiovanni said, I had a major epiphany in Conakry, Guinea in May 2000. I'd been robbed the night before, but I was still trying to bribe my way onto the last flight to Freetown. The rebel RUF were closing in on the capital, and anyone who could was scrambling for the last flights out. And I was trying to throw myself onto one of the empty helicopters flying into Freetown to evacuate people. What kind of person was I, running into the fire when everyone else was diving for cover? Those are the words of Janine DiGiovanni. So when she came into our studio, I asked her about what she wrote.
Well, I think that moment was a very interesting time because it was really when I realized that the importance of getting this story was almost more important than my own personal safety. I've changed a bit since then. I've become a mother, which throws a totally different dimension into my work. But I think the main thing was the importance I felt of getting into a story where there were hideous human rights violations occurring and that someone needed to be there to report it. And the more that people would run away and that I knew there was no reporters working, the more I felt compelled to go somewhere.
Tell us about Chechnya.
Chechnya was probably the scariest thing I've ever gone through.
Were you one of the only reporters to be there in the fall of Grozny?
Yes, there was myself, a German photographer, and a French woman who was working there as well. We weren't allowed into Chechnya, so we were there illegally. It was impossible for the Russian government to give you visas to get in, unless you went in with the Russian troops. So I smuggled myself into Chechnya, walked in, basically, with my satellite phone on my back. And the thing about being a print journalist, which is different from TV crew, is that you're alone. You know, I work alone. In this occasion, I was with a photographer. We got to the outskirts of Grozny, and the city fell. We hadn't planned it that way. I suppose it's a remarkable journalistic coup, but as a human being, it was absolutely terrifying because, you know, you never should be in a city when it falls. We were with the retreating Chechen army who had crossed a minefield to get out of Grozny. They had bribed Russian soldiers to get out, but the Russians had lied to them and tricked them and sent them over a minefield. So as soon as they began crossing it, they realized that they had been, you know, hideously fooled. And they began, you know, I think it was something like one in four of them blew up. So there were these incredibly sad stories of some guys saying, I'll go forward. You know, brother, I will go forward. And some went forward, sacrificed themselves. So when they got to this little suburb called Alkan Kala, they were wearing winter white uniforms. I'll never forget it. And they were covered in blood. And they were dragging the dead behind them. And because it was so unbearably cold, it was this kind of apocalyptic scene. And the line of the soldiers stretched for miles, and it was freezing cold, and we were stuck in this suburb, and there was one doctor, and he was amputating a lot of limbs because these guys had gone over a minefield. And he was set up in the school, and I remember going in, and I was walking, and my feet were sticking to something, and I looked down, and it was just blood everywhere. And I could hear these men screaming as he was operating because they didn't have a lot of anesthetic. And I went into some rooms to talk to some of the men, and they were blinded and missing arms and missing legs, and it was like a scene out of hell. And then I started trying to call my office, but of course, as usual, the one moment I really needed my satellite phone, my battery started dying, and there was no electricity. So I was desperately trying to find a generator to charge my batteries because it was my only link to the outside world. And I suddenly realized I'm, you know, a lone foreigner here with the photographer and this other woman. There was no MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, no UN, no Red Cross. So if something happened to us, that was it. And the worst thing came at night because the aerial bombardment, the Russians were bombing us with gunships, helicopter gunships, and then circled the town with tanks. And I was huddled in this kind of like potato cellar with this old woman Because most of the women had gone to an underground shelter, and I didn't want to go because I've always heard when the Russians come in, they throw grenades into the shelters. So it was the worst night of my life, basically. I was sure I was going to die. But I kind of thought, if I die, I'm going to go believing in what I did. You know, and I really felt, by that point, I'd filed my story, and I felt that I had witnessed something very, very crucial, that I was in the middle of history, and it was very important to explain the evil things that were happening. And, you know, there were some hideous human rights violations, and I wanted people to know what happened.
The siege of Sarajevo. Can you describe it?
You know, even now, it's 10 years since the war ended, I still feel so emotional about Sarajevo because I feel very bitter and very angry that the world did nothing. Sarajevo was this beautiful city, very cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, full of wonderful people, artists and writers and poets and Serbs and Muslims and Croats, and living side by side. And then this medieval siege, and it was a medieval siege, came, and the Bosnian Serbs were on the hills lobbing in rockets and grenades and mortars. And the worst was the sniping, because you'd go up to the hills and you could actually see these evil people that would hide behind sniper rifles and take aim at kids and women and aim at their knees. And we had no water, we had no electricity, we had no heat. And as a result, it was probably the most intense experience I've ever gone through, because the bonding with the people was so, you know, we were living like them, although I had one advantage. You know, if I wanted to leave, if the UN flight was going, I could get out. Those people were trapped. So I fell in love with that place and with the people and with their spirit, because even during the worst days, the darkest days of it, they just would not let the Serbs crush them. They just said, you know, we are not going to let them kill our spirit, because that was the point of it. When the Serbs bombed the National Library, they tried to destroy the heritage and the culture and the spirit of the city, but the people never let them. And to this day, it's the place when I think back on, I still get chills, and I still feel really strongly about it.
You were with a circle of journalists, many of whom are no longer alive. Can you talk about those people and where they died?
In Sierra Leone in 2000, June 2000, there was a rebel, horrible war in Sierra Leone, which took a terrible toll on the civilian population. The rebel RUF had this atrocious, heinous practice of amputating civilians so that they would be grotesque reminders to everyone of what they could do. So they would either amputate, they'd say, do you want long sleeves or short sleeves? And they'd either cut you off at the wrist or the elbow. And I saw a 9-month-old baby amputated. I just, you know, pure evil at work here. And two of my very brave friends and colleagues, one day, there was a group of us. I got in quite early, and I was one of the few people reporting from there, and then a lot of journalists came in, which is good because it was drawing attention to the story, and eventually the British troops arrived and stabilized it. But two of my friends, Kurt Schork and Miguel Gil de Moreno, one working for AP, the other for Reuters, decided to go a little bit further up a road that the rest of us didn't want to go up. There was a point where it, you know, the bush turned into a really dangerous, it was all dangerous, but they just pushed it a little further. And they went up to this place, Rogberry Junction, and they got ambushed. And they both died. Two cameramen who were with them escaped into the bush where they were hunted down for hours by rebels. And they survived. And they walked out of the bush, and they came back, and the next day, you know, we found out that our lovely, brave friends had been brutally killed. And Kurt Schork was an amazing man. He became a war correspondent when he was 40. Before that, he was a property developer. And he was a Rhodes Scholar with Bill Clinton, and he alone lived in Sarajevo. He stayed on when all the reporters left. He stayed there, and he stayed there till the bitter end. Very brave man, and I think journalism, you know, has a hole without him in it.
Other places in Africa, from Sierra Leone to Rwanda. You were in Rwanda when?
94. But I was there during the cholera epidemic in Goma, which was this very strange time. It was July. It was late summer. And the Hutus were in refugee camps. And some people say it was divine providence, but this awful cholera epidemic descended. And I remember walking down the road. I'm 5'8", and there were piles of bodies twice my height along the sides of the road leading, you know, for miles. And it was women holding their children in the final throes of death and old people struggling to breathe. And I remember going into one of the camps, and the smell was so bad that we had to wear bandanas wrapped around our noses, and someone just collapsed in front of me and started puking and sputtering, and then he just died. And it was this kind of, again, apocalyptic, horrible scene. And some years later, a psychiatrist who was doing a study on post-traumatic stress disorder and its effect on war correspondents interviewed me at length, and he said to me, "How many dead bodies have you seen?" And I said, "I don't know. You know, I've seen a lot of mass graves in Africa and Bosnia, and I saw a well in East Timor that was stuffed with bodies, and then there was Rwanda and Goma, and I don't know." And he was quiet, and then he said to me, "Do you think that's a normal answer? Because most people see their grandmother, their grandfather, maybe their parents in a coffin, but, you know, most people wouldn't give an answer like that. But you see, it felt totally normal to me. I didn't, until he pointed that out, I didn't realize how, you know, creepy that sounded."
Word. Veteran war correspondent Janine DiGiovanni, author of Madness Visible, a memoir of war. Back in a minute. The Sweet Talks here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to our conversation with war correspondent Janine DiGiovanni, her latest book, Madness Visible, a memoir of war. I asked her to talk about the members of her circle of journalists who were killed covering war.
The biggest problem is logistics. It's always, especially working alone. You know, if you're in a TV crew, you've got a producer, you've got a big team behind you. Usually the person who helps me the most is when I first arrive somewhere. I try to find a local translator, fixer, someone that will be my friend, my brother, my sister, my colleague, someone I've really got to bond with. And usually my instincts are right, and I pick someone that's fantastic and helpful. But sometimes you can get people that can get you into an even more dangerous position, or someone who's spying on you. I remember working in Vietnam, and I was given a government minder, and that was very difficult. In Iraq during the days of Saddam, I had a government minder who followed me everywhere, reported on my activities. But getting into places where we're not meant to be, a city under siege,
when you're not embedded.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the whole embedded thing is very strange to me. Someone described me once, they said she was embedded long before the term was invented, but I was always embedded with the losers. I've never been, you know, embedded with the American army or, you know, with the big war machine. I was always, you know, I suppose I was embedded with the Chechens or the Bosnian Muslims or the Falun Gong, but it was more that I wanted to live with them, to eat their food, to sleep on their floor, to really get under their skin so that I could tell their story. I remember the night I was sitting up all night in Chechnya waiting for what I thought would be my death. I was sitting with this bunch of really young soldiers, and they were about 17, 18. And they had that look in their eyes that I've seen a lot, which is the look that they're not going to be there on this earth much longer. And they kept saying to me, tell us some jokes. Please tell us some jokes. So we sat up all night long, you know, drinking tea. They had tea and eating some kind of disgusting food that someone had brought for us. I think it was just some mushy rice or something. And trying to kind of lighten the mood by making jokes with these guys. And they were telling me jokes. That to me is always the real tragedy when I meet someone and I kind of feel I'm leaving. I'm going to leave this story. I'm going to go home to the safety of my life. But these people stay behind and they might not be here much longer.
Janine, can you talk about Janine?
Yes, I can. That was a really controversial story. I and two of my colleagues, Sam Kiley of the Evening Standard and Phil Reeves, who's now with National Public Radio, finally walked into Janine. We were prevented from going in by the Israeli army, who also prevented the Red Cross from going in. We finally got in. I walked across an olive grove under an Israeli tank because I just thought, I've got to get inside this place. We don't know what is going on, and I'm not going to get the story from sitting in my car on the outskirts of Janine.
This was the original siege of Janine?
Yes, this was in April. The years are blurring for me now. Was it 2002? Yes, it's 2002, I think. I walked across an olive grove. I'll never forget it. And my colleague said, okay, we'll all go together inside, but you go first. So I walked with a very brave photographer called Judah Passau. And I remember turning around thinking there'd be a crowd of journalists behind me, but I was alone. So they were waiting to see if I got shot at, and then they were going to come next. But I got inside, and I have to say, I was really horrified by what I saw. They had leveled the town, the old town, to rubble, to a football pitch. It looked like it was completely destroyed. When I got in, people came running up to us saying, please, please, please come. I have to show you where my house was. And then they took us to piles of rocks. There was a man in a wheelchair who said he had been repeatedly trying to get out, but every time he came out, they kept taking shots at him. And I went around, I collected these testimonies. We stayed, I found a family to stay with, and we stayed inside the camp.
You were pregnant at the time?
No, not yet. I was pregnant the next time I went back in 2003. I wasn't pregnant then. We stayed with the family, and their house had been used as a sniper nest. And I got the diary of this young girl who had recorded her experience during the siege, and we sat up all night translating it. I'm always sitting up all night with people. Translated her diary, and it ran in the Times. I got a lot of flack for that story because I said, never in years of reporting have I seen such terrible destruction, or something like that. But I still stand by that because I will not forget Phil, Sam, and I coming out to that pitch that where they had leveled, and all of us just gobsmacked, absolutely gobsmacked. And I apparently said, Phil remembers me saying, We are going to get on the phones to our offices right now, and we've got to report this story. We can't let them get away with this. Now then, after the event, you know, stories came out, and people criticized us, the British press, saying that we had called it a massacre. I never called it a massacre, by the way, but to me, I think, what was the final count in the end? 50 or 60 people were killed, but that's still 60 civilians. And to me, you know, a human life is a human life. I still think it was a shocking story for me, and a painful one, because it was, you know, when I report these things, I tell the story of families and mothers, and I don't write about the tanks and the RPGs and the weapons that are used. I try to tell the story of people. And the stories that I collected, the testimonies, were heartbreaking.
You also, talking about the people you work with, worked with a woman who was raped. Can you talk about that experience and where you were?
That was horrible. That was in Kosovo, and it's a really sad story. She was my interpreter, and I was just, after the war in Kosovo ended, there was a State Department report which said there had been systematic rape in Kosovo, and I wanted to investigate this because I think systematic rape is a term that's tossed around a lot, and it's actually, it was used in Rwanda, but I didn't think it was used. I thought there was rape used as an act of war, but not as systematic, not to actually cleanse the gene pool, which is what the Hutus were trying to do in Rwanda. And for 1 month, I and this interpreter and I went around the camps getting testimonies from women. And when you interview rape victims, it's really tough because I've got to be quite diligent about getting facts. So I ask them the same questions over and over again just to make sure they're telling the truth. I know that sounds awful, but, you know, I'm a reporter. I've got to get the facts straight. So I would, you know, repeatedly kind of go back to the same question and say, you know, and get very detailed, very, very detailed accounts. Muslim women, you know, to be raped, Albanian Muslim women, is probably, there is no worse thing that can happen to them, because if their husbands find out, they'll never touch them again. They'll be basically tarnished, you know, thrown out of society. It's a very clannish, small society. So you can imagine how difficult it was getting these women to talk. And they never said rape. They'd say, he touched me. You know, and they'd say, and, you know, they made me take off all my clothes and then they touched me. And it was their kind of phrase for rape. And at the end of this month, you know, when I had collected hundreds and hundreds of pages of testimonies, one night I was sitting with my interpreter, and she had gone through a horrible ordeal at the beginning of the war, which is that she was in a cafe in Pristina. She was a young Albanian Muslim woman, and Serb paramilitaries came in and razed the cafe with machine gun fire, and her best friend that she was sitting having coffee with was killed, and the professor she was with was killed. Everyone in the cafe, in fact, except her, was killed. And she survived, but she was really traumatized. And anyway, at the end of this grueling month-long rape investigation, she just had a breakdown in my hotel room one night and told me that she had been gang raped by a group of Albanian men who had pulled her off a bus when she was crossing the border from Kosovo into Albania. And she just was absolutely destroyed by this experience. She had been a virgin. She was very young. And, you know, I held her and I tried to comfort her, but she just kept saying, you know, will I ever feel normal again? And then we eventually got her some psychiatric help, and I used to speak to the psychiatrist quite a bit, you know, to find out what was going on. And the experience was so horrible for her that she had a kind of psychotic break, which I think, I'm not a psychiatrist, but, you know, you could work it out, that the reality of life was so painful for her that she kind of slipped into another world. And I think for me to see someone so young who had been forever scarred by war and, you know, what man does to his fellow man, it was just absolutely heartbreaking.
Janine DiGiovanni is our guest, talking about post-traumatic stress for you, even for your husband. He reported for years from Ivory Coast.
Yes. My husband was living in the Ivory Coast. I was living there, too, when the coup broke out. That was in September 2002. And before that, we had quite an idyllic colonial African life, you know, the nice house, the swimming pool, the beach weekends, reporting from Ivory Coast, which was, at that point, the most stable West African country, sandwiched between Liberia and Sierra Leone. But it very quickly descended into a nasty, nasty civil war. And I was evacuated. My husband didn't want me there because they were beginning to rape women, and he couldn't protect me. He was out, you know, we had a guard who fled, everyone fled, and then we started seeing bodies in front of our house, naked, shot in the head, hands tied behind the back. So he had me evacuated. He stayed. All the journalists left except him and his crew and a few other people, a few other brave journalists. And my husband's a cameraman, so he has to be close to get pictures, and he was repeatedly beaten up, assaulted, death threats, assassination threats, and then a friend of his, a colleague, was assassinated by Ivorian police in cold blood. And they had repeatedly said that my husband and his team were going to be next. So he came back from the Ivory Coast with a feeling that he'd never be safe again, because he wasn't just reporting a war and then going back to Paris or London, which is what most of us do. He was living there. So every night when he closed the door of our house and went to bed, he didn't know when they would come for him with machetes or guns or clubs. And he got used to this horrible sense of never feeling safe, that you could be killed at any time. Post-traumatic stress is something that's always existed. I think the earliest recording was during the Trojan War, but it's only recently that we're beginning to be aware of it. Vietnam vets, World War II vets, came back with it and just never got any treatment. And I think there's...
It was called something else, shell shock.
Yeah, yeah. And they didn't really help them. They didn't know how to help them, unless it was, I think, during World War One they used shock treatments. But it manifests itself in a lot of ways, nightmares. Some people turn to addictions because of it, drug addiction, alcohol. You know, war itself is an addiction, so...
I was reading a piece you wrote in militaryweek.com as you then went home. You live in Paris. You had a baby. And you're watching another woman cover another place, Kate Payton of BBC, covering Somalia.
Yeah.
And then you hear what happened to her. And what is your feeling now?
Kate Payton was killed in Somalia a few months ago. And she was trying to report a story that's unreported. That's a very difficult story to write about. I've worked in Somalia. You must have a militia to protect you. It's a very dangerous place, which you don't have the kind of, you know, you work on a story like that, and it's not like Iraq, where you know you're going to get in the paper, you're going to get on TV. It's very hard to write about Africa because no one seems to want the coverage of it. And she was trying very bravely to bring this story to the world's attention, and she was killed. She was 39 years old. She was a mother. I have a baby son. He's 14 months old now, and he has in many ways redeemed me from a life of misery, of reporting it, misery and suffering and again, the evil that man does to man. He's a kind of light in my life. But it's very hard for me to work now, because before, if I was killed in Chechnya or if I was killed in the Ivory Coast or Liberia or Bosnia, it was me. I was alone. I didn't have relationships for many years because it was very hard to maintain relationships when you live that kind of life. But now I'm responsible for someone, and I was just given an assignment where I have to go back to Baghdad. And the last time I was there in October, or end of September, before I left, I sat up writing my son a letter the night before when I was packing my bag. And I was writing, you know, how much I loved him and how desperately I wanted him. And as I was writing, I was crying because I just thought, well, if you love him so much, what the hell are you doing? You know, this is not normal. You're a mother. You're putting yourself into a situation where you can potentially be kidnapped. And I'm an American. If I'm kidnapped, they're going to behead me on Al Jazeera. You know, it's not, they're not going to play around with, you know, hostage negotiation. We know that. So why was I doing this? And I went and I had the most terrible trip. I missed him so much. And I came back and that was 2 weeks long. And he was only 6 months old, or he was tiny. And I decided, okay, from now on, I am going to cover stories that have a real impact, you know, something human rights abuse or something where I actually might be able to make a difference, like writing about HIV in India or rape in the Congo, but something that I can control a bit. So I go a week or 10 days. My limit being away from him is 10 days now, and I don't think I'd put myself in a situation again where I'd be in Grozny when it's falling, or marching somewhere with a rebel army. I can't do that anymore. My life's changed.
Veteran war correspondent Janine DiGiovanni, her latest book, Madness Visible, A Memoir of War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, back in a minute. Vitamin C by Can, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Direct TV, Channel 375, Link TV, and on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and 9410, Link TV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and are closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. We also have a new edition on our website. Our headlines are translated into Spanish, both audio as well as transcript. You can go to democracynow.org and pass them around to people in this country and around the world. You can email your friends. Also at democracynow.org, you can sign up for our daily digest, our daily headlines that we send out around the country. Well, over 2,000 people converged in St. Louis, Missouri last weekend for the second ever National Conference on Media Reform. Among the keynote speakers, journalist, hip-hop historian, and radio DJ Davey D of Pacifica radio station KPFA. He talked about the clear channeling of America and the hip-hop generation. This is Davey D.
I've been involved with this sort of struggle about media accountability for a very long time. I think I can safely say, when I speak, especially for a lot of us who are in communities of color, dealing with the onslaught of media injustice and distortion has forced us to be in the fight, whether we cared to be in it or not. turning on the evening news and constantly seeing depictions of black males as criminals, unintelligent, and every other negative pathology that people like to talk about and the Bill O'Reillys of the world make a good living off of misreporting has forced us to be in this fight, and it's been going on for a long time. But there was a time where you wouldn't have this many people coming together to talk about reforming and changing the media. So give yourselves a lot of props for being out here, because this is a very strong showing. The thing that I always tell people is that media, we, at this point in time, 2005, we can no longer afford to treat media as a passive spectator sport. 2005, it requires us to step it up and be interactive. Interactive means that we hold everybody who is reporting the news, who is presenting information, who is on the airwaves that our tax dollars help pay for, we have to be in their faces 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every angle possible, whether you're coming at it from the low end, from the policy side, whether you're creating your own media to be competition to them, but we have to hold them accountable, because I can tell you, as somebody who's been involved with some of these stations that have laid out some of the groundwork for some of these ongoing assaults, and I work for Clear Channel for a number of years, that they spend a lot of time studying and figuring out ways to seduce and attract and lull a lot of the people who aren't in this room to sleep and make it seem like what they present is something that is all good and therefore there's no problem, until one day we wake up and find out that there's a lot of things we don't know about, there's a lot of laws that have been passed, there's a lot of things that are missing that are very important to our lives, but by then the train has left the station. So it's up to us in this room to not only continue to do the work that we're doing, but also to inform creatively and intelligently all those who may not find this issue very attractive. We have to do that. That means we have a responsibility to, first of all, to truly know the full spectrum of this game. I often tell a lot of the rap artists, before you get in the business, understand the game, that it's a business. Know the shot callers. If you don't know Rick Cummings or Jeff Smullyan, or John Hogan, or Doc Winters, or Steve Smith, or Kathy Hughes, or Alfred Liggins. These are people from Radio 1, Clear Channel, and Emmis Broadcasting, or Steve Rivers. If you don't know these people, then there's a problem, because these are the folks that shot call what goes on these airwaves day in and day out. And when we talk about radio, especially urban radio, in every city in America, these stations are the number one, or number two, or number three station in the market. So when we talk about a lot of the things about poor people and crime and prison industrial complex and things that we need to do to change that, and we look at media as being one of these agencies that may be moving people in the wrong direction but has the potential to move them in the right direction if it's used creatively and effectively, then we got to know that these are the people that are 40 and 50-year-old men and women behind the scenes calling the shots, deciding that at 7 at night you can hear the yin-yang twins talking about, wait until you see my D-I-C-K, and that is not a problem. That is a 40-year-old man that makes that decision, but then we'll blame the artists and we'll blame the kids for falling prey to the seducing techniques that these people do. I'm very happy that there's a lot of us on the other side of the spectrum, that hip-hop spectrum, the communities of color spectrum, that have been fighting a good fight and really making some headwaves. Malkia Sorrell, who was here earlier from Youth Media Council, probably talked to you about the very effective campaign that we ran in San Francisco with a lot of local artists who looked around and said, well, you know, news and information is cool, but for us it's the fact that local artists don't get on the airwaves. And so there was a well-heeled campaign that required us to monitor the stations and take notes and keep bringing the heat up. And we identified, we sat in the room and strategized, what's the weakness? And this is something that all of us can do. What's the weakness so that we can make sure that when we shoot the shot that we hit it effectively? So in 2005, you go to the Bay Area, you do hear local artists on the radio, but that victory is not enough for us. That victory is not enough because that's just a stall tactic so that they can continue to maybe misinform the community. So you have other people like my man Raheem Pierre, who's decided to go around the country, interview people from the inner city, get their perspectives, talk to artists, and then he brings to the forefront a documentary that he's going to drop in June called Radio Politrix to make sure the community understands what it takes to run a radio station and how these people are misleading us and abusing the airwaves. So these people deserve props. In New York City, 2002-2003, radio veteran Bob Law was sick and tired of the way that we were being mistreated in the media. So he brought together more than 1,000 people and held a tribunal in Harlem and brought everybody out there to talk about what was on with radio. 6 hours later, there was an earful that the city council people and everybody had. Started a campaign called Turn Off the Radio Campaign. People didn't pick this up. Fast forward to this year, Hot 97, which was one of the targeted stations, that's Emma's Broadcasting, decided to play a parody song making fun of the Asian community. They figured, you know what, these Asian folks, they're kind of small in number. They don't know anything. Nobody's going to hear them. But they didn't realize that some of those Asians that they pissed off were very good friends with the people from the Turn Off the Radio campaign. So black and Asians and Latinos all came together and brought the heat to Emmis Broadcasting, made their stocks plummet. Started strategically going, you know what? We're not going to talk about the DJs, Funkmaster Flex or Miss Jones and none of these people. We want to know Jeff Samoyan's name. We want to know Rick Cummings' name. We're going to put them on blast. And we started sending emails to advertisers. And people, and this got everybody involved. The hip-hop community from all over the country was supporting the effort in New York to the point that they had to call a meeting. And here's this. This is what we're up against in 2005. Hip-hop pioneer Afrika Bambaataa is sitting in the room. People like Rosa Clemente from our sister station, BAI, an activist well-known in New York, is there. DJ Cuttin' Candy, all these people who mean something to our communities are sitting in the room, intelligent human beings. They're asking for community access. They're asking for racial sensitivity. And more importantly, saying, you know, every time we turn on the radio, we hear your DJs using the N-word and the B-word and other disparaging words that we say we don't want to hear anymore of. White program director who never programmed an urban station in his life sat up there and looked these people in the face, looked Afrika Bambaataa in the face, the man who started the hip-hop movement that he's making money off of, said, no, we can't stop using the N-word because we don't want to lose our lower demographics. This is in 2005. This is the fight that we're dealing with. So when you turn on the radio and you go, what's going on? It's not the people in our neighborhood that's making these decisions. Let me just quote, I think it was Rick Cummings or Jeff Samoyan, who said, well, you know, we don't know what these young people, we don't know what's going on with these young people. How do I know? I'm a 50-year-old white guy. I don't know about hip-hop. Then why the hell do you have a license for the number one station in that market? This is the fight that we have. But we are winning it. First thing, I tell people all the time, recognize our victories. We shifted the conversation from talking about the artists and the shortcomings of the DJs to talking about the shortcomings and the lack of responsibility of the broadcast owners. So that's a major victory right there. And we will continue to bring the heat. Big shout out to the folks from Industry Ears who decided that, you know what, these folks are doing a smack fest where they get sisters to smack each other until they start bleeding. And then the corporation, Emma's Broadcasting, gives them $500 when one of them gives up. Well, they didn't think hip-hoppers were smart. We're all 30-plus. We all have houses and homes. One of them was a law student, found out that it's a violation of New York state laws to have a pugilistic competition. And then one of the fools from Emmis went on Hannity and Combs and said, it's just like a boxing match. So a few phone calls later, and Elliot Spitzer and a few city council conversations brought it up on charges and said, you can't have a pugilistic competition. You're violating New York City state law. These and others are victories that are taking place. And these victories come because of several things. One, we communicate with each other. Two, it's not about the individual and it's not about one organization, but it's about all of us looking out for the future generations that are coming up that are being seduced by these broadcasters day in and day out who think it's okay for them to do the things that they do because they don't live in the East Oaklands, they don't live in the South Sides of Chicago, they don't live in the Harlems, but we do, and we have to deal with the nonsense that they leave. So we're committed to it. Young women up in Boston, we got to give them a major shout out because they got sick and tired of what was going on and they decided to start their own radio station. Big shout out to my crew in Los Angeles. They started their own. Big shout out to people like Freemix and all those websites and podcasters. These are communities of color doing their own thing, creating their own media, trying to not only counteract what's going on, but to make themselves competitive and hopefully surpass some of these people who are misusing the airwaves today. So those people deserve props, and I wish that those stories could be told in more fuller detail, but I'm going to represent for them tonight and give them a round of applause because they're not here, but they're hard at work. Lastly, as I close, the big white elephant that's in the room that we're getting ready to deal with, the big white elephant that is determining a lot of the stuff that we have to deal with day in and day out, the big white elephant that is saying, you know what, we're going to play these nasty songs for seven-year-olds in the middle of the morning. We're going to keep some of these beefs going on because it makes us money, et cetera, et cetera. The payola word. A lot of people don't like to talk about it. The commissioners are here. We're making these recordings and making it known that what is on these airwaves is bought and paid for by corporations. We got to deal with that because nothing else that we do will matter if you got big-time money funding some of the nonsense that we're up against right now. And it doesn't stop with the records. Maybe some of the news things that we hear, as Commissioner Edelstein had alluded to, maybe those are bought and paid for, too. So don't talk about the war effort. You're paid not to. Let's not play any of the anti-war songs. There are four compilation albums out by hip-hop artists. Not one of them gets on the air. Who's paying for that not to happen? In closing, all of us got to continue to do three things. One, communicate with one another. Continue to network with one another. Use each other's resources. And more importantly, recognize that all of us have strengths and that we should use these to our full advantage to make sure that next year, when we come to this sort of gathering, that the landscape has significantly changed for the better. Thank you very much.
Davey D., hip-hop historian, Pacifica radio producer at KPFA at DaveyD.com, speaking at the National Conference on Media Reform last weekend in St. Louis, Missouri. And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can link to other information about today's program, as well as get the headlines in Spanish and sign up for our daily headlines that we send out around the world to listeners and viewers. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Sharif sat in for Mike DeFilippo today. Also thanks to Tyshawn Black and Orlando Richards, Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker, and the whole team that makes Democracy Now!'s broadcast possible. Special thanks to Nell Geiser and Maddie Harper. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!